Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, March 1st, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a glorious 63 degrees and sunny, feeling very springy here in upstate New York, though. I am looking at the radar right now, and it looks like there are some big-ass storms headed this way with red tornado warning boxes in them. So I guess we'll see. It was supposed to get a little dicey tonight. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show AI, Google, Jigsaw, Schmidt, as in Eric Schmidt, Cohn, as in Jared Cohn, the CFR, State Department, and quote-unquote extremism. And I had run across a story the day before. It was titled something like Toxic Comment Detector. We'd been reading about it. It was some new thing that Alphabet's Jigsaw was working on that would go out, search, and destroy toxic comments left on articles. We discovered the New York Times is going to be the first to start testing it to manage the huge influx of comments they get on a daily basis. And I don't know if that experiment has actually started or not yet, but we had discovered that apparently the New York Times must have a lot of hate speech, and so they had to tamp down on that hate speech. And that is where this Jigsaw project came from, and we read all about it yesterday. And it was really interesting because it was way beyond hate speech. It went into ferreting out jihadis, redirecting them, utilizing advertisements to be able to then get them to a website where you could unbrainwash them. This was according to the Wikipedia. I don't know. It was pretty interesting that a Google subsidiary had a gentleman who was a real youngin' too. I think he's only 31 now. He was one of the Time Top 100 in 2013. He worked for the State Department under Bush and Clinton, and then became a member of CFR before joining Alphabet. Just got to make you wonder. So he and Eric Schmidt did these travels all over, went to Afghanistan and Pakistan, and I don't remember if they went to the subcontinent of Africa. They were looking at what's going to happen when all these people come online and what kind of genocide they have in Rwanda. And then he goes over to Google, starts helping to roll out these anti-extremist applications. Well, I did a little more searching on him, and I thought we might just want to read this last little blurb here about him. This is out of Time Magazine. And I don't know, then we'll put Jared Cohn on a shelf for a while. I'll dig into him a little more. This week has been kind of tough. I'm just getting back from being gone for, I don't know, a few days with Chris, President's Day vacation, and with the flu and all that other stuff. So it's Wednesday already, guys. It's like, I need a break. All right, Jared Cohn, Times 2013 Time 100. Doesn't say what number he is, but he was up there, I think. All right, Jared Cohn, Idea Man, 31. As a graduate student, and we found out, he went to all these Ivy League schools, and he definitely was connected to the machine. As a graduate student, oh yeah, and the other thing was to be able to support color revolutions through social media. That was another one of his big projects. To knock off countries from the chessboard just by using Twitter. As a graduate student, Jared Cohn wangled a visa to Iran. Not sure how he did that. Oh, wait, now he's in the CFR. Where He hung out at internet cafes and at house parties fueled by bathtub gin. From there, his journeys took him to beach parties in Lebanon, Palestinian refugee camps, raves in Syria organized using Bluetooth, and other places not usually frequented by a nice Jewish boy from Connecticut. Now, after I read that intro sentence, I thought to myself, well, that almost sounds like Anderson Cooper. If I didn't know any better, where is a graduate student traveling the Middle East, just meeting people, doing things, going to bathtub gin parties, and hanging out in seedy internet cafes? I don't know anyone who does that, especially some little white boy from Connecticut. Come on. Notice they don't say when this was, but he joined the State Department during Bush's reign under Condoleezza Rice. So, and he's only 31. So, I mean, even if it was 10 years ago, making him 21 and he would still probably be in grad school, that was still a dicey time. I don't know anyone who would go traveling to the Middle East and just go hitting Lebanon and whatever. I mean, remember Brandon? Brandon tries to get into Syria. He couldn't get into Syria. They made him get stuck in Lebanon. The Lebanon seemed like it was pretty nice, but I don't know about going to Iran, hanging out in Palestinian refugee camps, and going to raves in Syria. Anyway, out of these experiences came a book. And this book was called Children of Jihad, and a fascination with life at the intersection of technology and geopolitics. He then joined the State Department's policy planning staff, and along with other geo-geeks like Alec Ross, helped shape what became known as 21st century statecraft, which added social media to the toolkit of diplomacy. When Twitter was planning to shut down for maintenance right before the 2009 Iranian elections, ding, remember I told you that was that Arab Spring, and when it first started, when Obama got elected and he was inaugurated, those elections happened, they all stood up and said no. I'm pretty sure that they didn't want old school Iranian rule. They wanted to get rid of it and go more Western, and we didn't come for them. We didn't come help them. We didn't do anything. We let them all get prosecuted. Well, remember that rising was all perpetrated through social media. That was a color revolution. So check this out. So interesting that this Jared Cohen was right in the middle of all that as a graduate student. When Twitter, well, right out of college, when Twitter was planning to shut down for maintenance right before the 2009 Iranian elections, Cohen persuaded the company not to because it had become an organizing method for young dissidents. So this one kid just out of grad school went to Twitter, granted he works for the State Department, and said, hey, Iran is about ready to have an election. You better not shut down for maintenance because it's a tool for young dissidents. What? And so Twitter kept it up. Okay, they just kept the service up because we knew there was going to be a revolution. Wink. I couldn't believe it. And yeah, they published it like it was fact in Time Magazine. In 2010, then, Cohen left the State Department to found Google Ideas. Which, yeah, like Eric Schmidt just stepped right out and said, hey, young nobody, you've worked at the State Department and traveled around the Middle East. Here, I'm going to give you this new division. This brand new division at Google with lots of money. We don't even know who you are, but we're going to give it to you, and we're going to call it Google Ideas. It gets rebranded as Jigsaw. We're going to travel all over, you and me, Eric Schmidt, CEO of Alphabet. We're going to go to Pakistan and Afghanistan. We read that yesterday. They did. So in 2010, Cohen left the State Department to found Google Ideas, which focuses on how technology can help make the world better. And one example, in April, he led Google in donating $3 million to create a database to connect 65 independent hotlines used to report human trafficking. I'm not going to make any comments on that one, but very interesting. And you know, I was thinking about some other things yesterday as we were reading his wiki, and it was going through all the projects that Jigsaw is a part of. One of them is hiding your IP address so you could be a dissident in some other country. And of course, they wouldn't know where you were because you were behind something that would be like a Cloudflare-esque type thing, except that Google would know and the State Department would know. And who else were they working with? I don't know. This is just one big sticky ball of stinky wax. I tell you guys that all the time. And they try and make us think that we're not playing ball with them, except that Google is them. Google has been a part of them for a very long time. Google's tagline back in the 90s, Google is not evil. It makes you wonder why they had a tagline, Google is not evil. So yes, they created a $3 million database system to connect 65 independent hotlines to report human trafficking. And I was thinking about how DARPA Dan, not only do we have Kurzweil there, and we had that Regina Duggan, who's now gone over to the Moonshots division on Facebook. She came from DARPA to Google to Facebook. But we have DARPA Dan still at Google. DARPA Dan had just finished developing his Memex project, which was the search engine that put Google to shame for the dark web. And they were so excited because it was going to allow them to track human traffickers and drug dealers and all the things that happen on the dark web, ferret them out, be able to see all their connections through social media and build a map about who you are and who you deal with. I'm going to think here, guys, when we were looking at some of the projects that Jigsaw is working on, and one of them was hiding people's IP addresses so they can be revolutionaries without anyone knowing, but only if you're in another country, one that we're interested in and want to create a revolution so we can flick you off the chessboard. Yes, one of those countries. Well, if you're there, I bet we are going to run a Memex tool against you. And you know, you should watch, and I'll have to find it. It was a 60-minute interview with Leslie Stahl, the blonde woman, and DARPA Dan. And we listened to a good part of that interview here way back when we were looking at the self-driving cars and how easy they were to hack. And he did a whole presentation on that with a notebook computer just in a parking lot and showing how you could take control of the car and make it do all kinds of crazy stuff, which, of course, notice nobody's talking about now. They're just getting ready to roll these all out, but they're not talking about any of it. There was a whole safety commission on that, too. I had read the safety commission's findings, and there were a lot of security holes in many of the manufacturers' self-driving car products back in last year. But DARPA Dan did a second segment where he actually exposed Memex, and he showed the tool, and it was a big Surface computer touchscreen. It allowed them to be able to pick a target, which in the future could be you and me, and get an entire profile. And I've talked about this before, this whole dossier that they've been collecting on us for many years now. Okay, this isn't even just something that just happened. Okay, this has been many years of the internet. And I don't know about you, but I got my first computer in 1982. I don't know. First time I got online was Prodigy. HXPK29C. I think that was my original email address at Prodigy.com. And it's long gone, so don't send email there. But I mean, that was a long, long, long time ago. So anything I have done since those days, and I don't think they were technologically savvy enough to be able to be collecting data back in those days, but I think that they were already trying to figure out how to do that. And they were already surveilling people in different ways, like the little red laser light on the wall Christmas Eve. And no, that wasn't Rudolph's nose. I don't even remember what year that was. It was probably, God, it might have been nine. So that might have been like 1977, 1976, somewhere along in there. But this Memex tool allows them now to dig places and look at things and make correlations that they were never able to do before. Remember, of course, it's all in the name of fighting terrorists, finding drug traffickers, finding human traffickers, just like Gerald Cohen's new tool and his $3 million to create a database for human trafficking hotlines. You know, and they got to throw something like that out there. And not that I want there to be human trafficking, of course not. But always remember that they put this veil over something and they go, oh, it's to catch the human traffickers. Oh, it's to catch the drug dealers. But that's just what they're telling you it's for. And then they go, oh, look at all these other great things we could use it for, wink. Not that we didn't have plans to do that before. We could track everybody. And I don't know, maybe you're a potential human trafficker. We just had to take a look and make sure that you weren't. Don't worry about it. Go back to sleep there, Johnny. So anyway, Jared Cohen and Google chairman Eric Schmidt just published a book, and that was in 2013, titled The New Digital Age. And that analyzes the global transformation that is happening. And it should establish Cohen as one of the preeminent navigators of the entire networked world. Now, that should be disturbing to you because we don't even know who this guy is, but he's some little smarty pants, some little rich smarty pants who got himself all connected up, and he seemed to have been chosen. He picked all the right schools, made all the right friends, and got all the right jobs, and just went to raves in Syria while he was a grad student. It's just unbelievable. And now he's one of the most connected people who's making not only all this policy, but building all these back-end applications to be able to monitor, spy, and all kinds of different things. And there is major crazy going on here. Peter Thiel is another one. I don't know, I guess we might as well talk about some of these people who are shaping our world, and we don't even really kind of know who or what these people are doing. There was a story that came out a while ago titled, and this was in December, and I've had this, I've had this in the corner, open to the far left, so it was kind of out of the way, but I knew it was important. Open since December. Is Peter Thiel the most powerful person in technology? Now, if we remember Peter Thiel was the tech billionaire, was really interested in longevity. He is a, if I'm not mistaken, he was a PayPal billionaire. And actually, he and Elon Musk, I think, worked together. I don't know if they get along too well now. But Peter Thiel was the same Peter Thiel who has put now his money where his mouth is, funding research into parabiosis. We talked about parabiosis. That was the young blood into the old organism. Old organism takes, no, wait, young blood into the old. Old blood into the young. And there are some proteins or something in the blood that, yes, guess what? The young blood actually does make the old organism younger. And the old blood actually makes the younger organism older. That Peter Thiel, well, is Peter Thiel the most powerful person in technology? Well, there are generally two paths for dealing with someone in power when disagreements arise. Remember, Peter Thiel was one of biggest tech supporters of Donald Trump, and he has now slid his way into a seat as a bug in Trump's ear. He was helping them make decisions on some of the key new people that they're going to be putting into positions of power, making decisions on healthcare. So put in a seatbelt, people, because remember when I told you when Trump was first elected and we took a look at what biotech stocks were doing to see whether or not this mad science was going to be kiboshed? And the biotech stocks went through the roof. And we determined at that point, well, I guess this train is not going to stop. Well, nope. They sped it up a little bit. Peter Thiel is now helping put all kinds of crazy longevity ideas into Trump's ear. He's probably got him on Kurzweil's longevity cocktail by now, telling him he can live forever. Anyway, there are generally two paths for dealing with someone in power when disagreements arise. One is to confront, and the other is to understand and influence. And what is interesting is the most common path taken is the former, which is to have a confrontation. Well, the most successful is the latter. And I got to tell you, I don't know, just as a side note, after 49 years of life, I have come to that same conclusion. I don't know, I walked around for many years of my life with a chip on my shoulder, kind of like my daughter does. Drives me batshit crazy, where every other thing I say, she has an alter argument or an alter way of looking at it. Just any reason not to go along with me 100% and to have her own independent view, which, you know, I don't know, made me who I am today being like that. But wow, is it irritating if you're the one in charge. So, yes, I tend to, instead of always trying to start an argument or poke somebody, I try to just listen to both sides now. And even if I don't agree at all, and they're trying to sell me an alter point of view, I'll listen to it. And I don't know, sometimes I don't even bother arguing. I just go, There are some people that you just can never get through to. So why make hard feelings? Life is too short. Anyway, that's Jules' wisdom for today. Don't argue, only fight for those who are worth it. Anyway, so what is interesting is that the most common path taken is the one to fight, but the most successful is the latter. And I think that the reason is that the former path is the natural path for disagreement and the most visible, but confrontation is always more newsworthy than influence. But when done right, and yes, this is what my old boss taught me, and he's a double black belt. John knew what he was talking about. He used to tell me, you always make them believe it's their idea. Don't try to force your idea down their throat. Make them think it's their idea, and they're more willing to open their arms and accept it. And I see that now. I see that working all over the place. Pretty interesting. It's using a psychological flip on you. But when done right, exerting influence is the odd result of not conveying credit, which that's what I said. You are influencing, but you don't come off as the one who actually did it. You make them believe that it's their idea. So it is the odd result of not conveying credit while actually making far more progress. So you get your agenda one way or the other, you just don't get credit for it. But hey, guess what? When you're a billionaire, you don't really need credit for much of anything anymore. Who gives a shit? At 5 o'clock, you go hop on your yacht and drink some martinis and rub elbows with other billionaires. You don't need to take credit for things, but you do like to get your way, and it does help you invest in the future. This suggests that one of the ways to determine whether someone is doing something because they believe in the outcome versus doing it for the fame and status is whether they move to influence or to confront. But the vast majority of tech executives and politicians have confronted Trump. And I talked about that with Elon Musk and that tech council that they have. Most of the tech leaders bailed on that conference. And Elon Musk stuck around and he said, hey, you know, at least I'm here on this board and at least I can help influence some things. And see, that's exactly what Elon did. Like I say, love to hate him. I really want to like Elon because he is smart and he's got some great ideas, but he's playing both sides of the fence, people. Remember, he's invested in this technology. He is a billionaire. He's got all the rich boy toys, including his rocket ship. I just saw there was a story that came out yesterday, the day before. 2018, I believe, is what it said. 2018, they are planning on sending the first two space tourists on SpaceX, and they are going to give them a zip around the moon somehow. So hopefully they've come up with some sort of carbon nano tubule spacesuit that'll protect them from the radiation once they get outside of the magnetosphere. I think we also read about CERN developing an artificial magnetosphere, so maybe they'll have that up and running by 2018. Not sure how they're going to do that, but anyway, that is the plan. Back to this. The vast majority of tech executives and politicians confronted Trump, which had little impact on him, while Peter Thiel actually moved in to influence. Ding. And as a result, he now may be the most powerful person in technology, even though that did not appear to be his goal, or at least we think. And I think it's interesting because Elon Musk, being the other tech executive that kind of kept his toe in the water in the White House, being someone that worked with Peter Thiel, that's both how they made their money, was on PayPal. And I don't know if these two actually see eye to eye. Maybe Elon Musk is watching out for our best interest, with Peter Thiel being a major influencer on the White House now, as he knows about Peter Thiel. I don't know, just saying. I don't know. Do we read a collaboration? Let's Thiel versus Gawker. I don't know if I want to get into the whole history of Peter Thiel, because Peter Thiel comes up in another story. This one now, so that was December 16th or 19th, 2016. This one is February 27th, which was 2 days ago. Peter Thiel, Trump's, quote, shadow president, unquote. Yes, shadow president in Silicon Valley, invests in the Theranos of nuclear power. Silicon Valley's most prominently polarizing billionaire, Peter Thiel, has his fingerprints all over the Trump administration, according to a new report. We speak, of course, of Peter Thiel, PayPal co-founder, libertarian, and member of Trump's transition team. Meanwhile, another report described Thiel's fingerprints on a firm just called the Theranos of the nuclear power industry after it was probed by a group of MIT professors who found its claims to be overblown, as were those of the infamous Palo Alto blood testing startup. But first, back to the nation's capital. To get cozy with the most powerful man in the world, Thiel got in on the ground floor, seating the Trump administration with his proxies, a political report had said. And working with a staff of 4 to 6 aides from the office in the Trump Tower, Thiel dispatched associates from his investment firm to help staff agencies across the government. Now, again, so we got Peter Thiel, billionaire, with his big investment firm, dispatching associates to go help agencies all across the government. Ding-a-ling-a-ling. His reach, get this, extended from the Department of Commerce to the Pentagon and eventually to the White House, where one of his closest aides, Kevin Harrington, was recently elevated to National Security Council. Ding. Someone identified as a senior Trump transition aide told our news outlet that when you have offices and you bring staff with you and you attend all the meetings, then you have lots of power. That power has given, it appears, a very high seat indeed to Thiel, who is 49, the iconoclastic PayPal co-creator, Facebook investor, venture capitalist, and co-founder chairman of data analysis firm Palantir, which calls itself, and get this, quote, the war on terror's secret weapon, unquote. So here's another one who's going to be using big data to help identify us extremists out there who aren't going along with the approved narrative. It's amazing. And I just actually, there was another story I queued up today about some big data analytics that they're doing as well. This is just incredible. At the Presidio, the old Army fort in San Francisco, where Thiel's investment firms are housed, many of his employees have taken to calling him, quote, the shadow president. Thiel's push into political power fits a pattern. His support for Trump was a signature long shot bet that is paying big dividends in terms of access to and influence on the new administration. A Thiel spokesman declined to comment, but the news outlet said a senior White House official had said only that, quote, Peter has been a very prominent supporter of the president, and we are grateful for his support. According to another report, Thiel has also been a supporter of Transatomic Power, which is a Massachusetts startup that claims its molten salt nuclear reactor could generate spectacular amounts of energy. And that's one of these. And I've looked at these molten salt reactors, and I gotta tell you, they are pretty damn interesting. But nobody looks at what to do with the waste, and I really don't know. I thought these were maybe using a type of radioactive salt, and that's what it was, and it just got hot, super, super freaking hot. But I don't know about disposal or half-lives or anything about, I think it was thorium, something like that, that they were putting in there. So I'm going to reserve comment on that. But you might want to look at some of these molten salt reactors. They are pretty interesting. Might be a little bit safer than big, nasty plutonium fuel rods or uranium or MOX or whatever they're putting into them now. But anyway, this molten salt nuclear reactor could generate spectacular amounts of energy from what? Oh, spent nuclear fuel rods produced at conventional reactors. So that's interesting as well. It's going to use spent fuel. So instead of sending it over to the Middle East to be able to deploy as depleted uranium bombs that we dump on third world nations, we could start using it to make new molten salt reactors. I don't know how that's going to work out. Spent fuel is still with all the nasty poisons. So, all right, I'm reserving comment. Anyway, this claim helps Transatomic bring in millions of dollars from investors, including Thiel's Founders Fund, according to an article February 24th. But the transatomic assertions caught the attention of MIT's nuclear science and engineering professor, Cord Smith, who in 2015 analyzed the firm's projections and then enlisted two academic colleagues to probe further. And they told the MIT Technology Review that they believed transatomic claims were incorrect based on basic physics. So who the hell knows? So we got Peter Thiel pushing some sort of nuclear agenda here, it looks like, with some sort of molten salt reactor using spent fuel rods. And MIT professors are saying that it doesn't even follow the basic laws of physics. So I guess we'll have to see how this pans out. MIT Smith noticed that Transatomic failed to subject its technology early on to peer review, but suggested the overblown claims were not crafted to deceive. And there have been a lot of people over the last few years claiming that they've had these molten reactors or fission, that'll just burn forever. And no one has really been able to show tons and tons of reproducible proof on that. So I guess we'll see. But I guess the disturbing part is, so here we are, Peter Thiel, who has had influence all the way up to the Pentagon. Now Peter Thiel, that's going to help them come up with all kinds of new people to bring into the federal institution. Now Peter Thiel, who's even investing and helping build a new nuclear industry, something that we've been trying to get rid of for a very long time. It's kind of disturbing. Who is this guy? Does he have our best interest at heart? He is the young blood dude who messed around with parabiosis. I'm having a flash crash. I'm having a flash crash. I don't know. I think we should be careful. And I do have another story, but I might have to sing. It's just amazing how this shit happens to me. Can I just tell you how on a daily basis? And look, it is my Acer Updater software that just right in the middle of my show decided it's going to begin running. And when it begins running, it completely ruins my browser. Here, we're going to try to end it now. End now. It sucks all my machine's memory. And now, otherwise, I'm going to have to sing ding-a-ding-ding-ding-ding-ding and then pull random stories off my Facebook page. Don't make me do that because I have a show lined up. Oh, oh, oh. Come on. All right. Well, I at least got back to the story with little Johnny sitting with big blank eyes staring at a robot. And this was the story from the other day that was titled, "What Will Happen When Robots Become Role Models?" And we discover that children are very impressionable. And yes, robots can become role models for our future children. We also found out that Facebook is monitoring us with their emoticon algorithm. And they are using artificial intelligence to try to create some sort of profile on you. Try to figure out, sociologically speaking, how groups, large groups especially, like us, interact with each other. There was a story the other day, and I don't know, I might get thwarted here. My other computer, after we looked up the Jigsaw story, my other computer is just white screening everything. I can't even get it to load anything, so I'm going to have to kill everything and relaunch it from scratch. All right, so where do we go? I don't even know what I want to talk about. Well, we had a whole bunch of brain hacking stuff I wanted to get into today, but it's kind of ruined now. So we have robots becoming role models. We have brain implants coming. Yeah, it's so yesterday. There was a good story that came out of the Atlantic talking about brains. You know, we talk about this brain initiative and all this other crazy stuff here, and implants and Kurzweil saying how our neocortex is going to be connected 24/7 so we could access cloud learning on the fly. Well, listen to this one. I have to give some kudos. There are 5 neuroscientists that are stepping up, and they are on our side. Thank goodness. Only 5. This one is titled, and it's not just us that are being tinfoil hat wearing because we are not crazy. This has gotten out of control. How scientists forgot that brains actually have owners. Yes, there are people tied to those brains that you're experimenting on. 5 neuroscientists argue that fancy new technologies have led the field astray. It is a good time to be interested in the brain. Neuroscientists can now turn neurons on and off with just a flash of light. We've read all about optogenetics, allowing them to manipulate the behavior of animals and soldiers with exceptional precision. They can turn brains transparent as well. We talked about that story way back when. And seed them with glowing molecules to define their structure. They can also record a huge activity of a number of neurons at once. We've talked about that too. And those are just the tools that currently exist. In 2013, Barack Obama launched the brain research through the Advanced Innovative Neurotechnologies Initiative, more affectionately known as the Brain Initiative, $115 million plan to develop even better technologies for understanding the enigmatic gray blob that sits inside of our skull. John Krakauer, a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins Hospital, and remember, that's where they have that big brain database of children. We've talked about that a few different times. Has been asked to the Brain Initiative meetings before, and he describes them like, quote, maleficent, being invited to Sleeping Beauty's birthday, unquote. And that is because he and four like-minded friends have become increasingly disenchanted by their colleagues' obsession with their new toys. And that would be like the optogenetic toys, the mind-reading toys, and all this other brain research craziness that we've talked about. There are five neuroscientists going, what? You people are nuts, because all you're trying to do is like be dystopian versus actually doing it for the research. And in a new paper that's part of the philosophical treatise and part shot across the bow, they argue that this technological fetish is leading the field astray. And I'm going to say across the board, 21st Century Cures Act is fueling this technological fetish that is being venture capitalized by people like Peter Thiel, that is sending this on a left turn off the tracks and putting the future of the human race in danger. This is the whole premise of my show, and we have five neuroscientists who agree. I was beyond happy when I read this story. Anyway, John Krakauer, this Johns Hopkins Hospital neuroscientist, says, quote, people think that technology plus big data plus machine learning equals science. And it does not, he says. He and his fellow curmudgeons actually had a beer by founders called Old Curmudgeon, and it was pretty damn good. It was a dark ale, I think. The Old Curmudgeon. He and his fellow curmudgeons argued that brains are special because of the behavior they create. Everything from a predator's pounce, and you remember they did that to the little mousies. I don't remember what they did to the mice. We read about that maybe a month or so ago. They turned mice into predators, where they started to kill things and eat other creatures. They would bite uncontrollably. That's what it was. They create behavior, everything from a predator's pounce to a baby's cry. But the study of behavior is being deprioritized or studied, quote, almost as an afterthought. Instead, neuroscientists have been focusing on using their new tools to study individual neurons or networks of neurons. And remember, it's because they are working on reverse engineering the brain. They've been focusing on these new tools to study individual neurons or networks of neurons. And according to Krakauer, the unspoken assumption is that if we collect enough data about our parts, the workings of the whole will become clear. If we fully understand the molecules that dance across a synapse, or the electrical pulses that zoom along a neuron, or the web of connections formed by many neurons, we will eventually solve the mysteries of learning, memory, emotion, and more. But the fallacy is that more of the same kind of work in the infinitely postponed future will transform into knowing why that mother's crying or why I'm feeling this way. And he and his colleagues argue, no, it will not. And that is because behavior is emergent. It arises from a large group of neurons working together and isn't from one single neuron. You will never have been able to predict one from the other, no matter how thoroughly you understood physics. If you are looking at a flock of birds and they look like they are in perfect coordination. Uh-oh. These simple rules have a collective complexity, and we might get stuck all of a sudden. No, I'm back. All right. So, long story short, behavior is where these neuroscientists think that we should be spending our time and effort. They think that science has gone off the rails because all they're doing is trying to recreate the brain and understand how to make neurons. I'm going to tell you, good old Tommy Insel, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, also being over at Google, in Google's Verily division, working on diagnosing mental disease and curing it, should be something you keep an eye on, because these guys maybe don't understand that they are working on behavior and behavior monitoring, behavioral surveillance in the 21st Century Cures Act. You've got to do the behavior first. You cannot fly the plane while building it. Studying how owls listen out for scurrying prey, neuroscientists discovered how their brains and later those of mammals localize sound. And by studying how marmosets call to each other, they learned about the rules that govern turn-taking in human conversation. Bats, sea slugs, and electric fish have also told us a lot about how brains work because each has its own specialized skill. I am thrilled to see a paper that emphasizes the importance of carefully studied behavior. And in neuroscience, I've seen that behavior is often an afterthought, studied with insufficient understanding of the animal strategy. It's difficult to get animals to behave in a lab because you need to recreate aspects of their world that isn't obvious to us. And if your goal is to understand the brain, you have to understand behavior. It is not trivial. And a lot of neuroscientists think that it is. Well, I'm going to tell you, though, the ones that are understanding artificial intelligence, social media like Jared Cohen, and being able to correlate groups, look at what they're doing, and then be able to pull analytics and data and future profiling out of that are what we have to be careful of. There is a lot of that going on right now. And one of the stories that I ran across before I went to bed last night, this was in my feed for, I think, neurons. I think that was one of my searches, neurons. And it caught my attention. No, this one was under DARPA. DARPA's Defense Department, DARPA, and a company called Sparks and Honey team up to fight terrorism. The story came out yesterday. I was like, who the hell is Sparks and Honey? Well, the Department of Defense's Advanced Research Project Agency, more affectionately known as DARPA, is now working with a company named Sparks and Honey to examine the growth of terrorism. Oh, really? And extremism, really? After we just find out about the toxic comment detector and Jared Cohen and all of his work with the State Department and CFR and Google about tracking down extremists. Oh, yes. DARPA is in on the game as well. And they want to gather cultural insights to help counter those initiatives. To gather these insights for DARPA, Sparks and Honey, who happens to be an advertising agency out of New York City, is now implementing the Cortex strategy model, which has helped build in partnership with Analect for Omnicom's dedicated McDonald's agency titled We Are Unlimited. And I don't know who any of these people are. I don't know. That'll be for the further research. The Cortex, this Cortex strategy that they are implementing, examines what? Oh, human behaviors. Yes, it does. And social sciences in real time. Remember, I talked about that Memex tool, DARPA Dan, who now works for Google. They can look at things in real time and look at who's communicating. They can look at all your social media profiles, and they can give you a color coding already across all platforms as to whether or not you should be considered a potential future threat. And it tries to understand, quote, what drives someone to become radicalized, unquote. The CEO of Sparks and Honey, Terry Young, says that the Omnicom shop combines its social science expertise with cultural expertise with DARPA's great data science minds. And while Mr. Young cannot go into detail about the agency's findings, and that would be the findings about what drives someone to become radicalized, quote unquote, because they are highly confidential, he says that the objective is to, quote, create a mechanism to understand human behavior, to monitor that behavior, and then to translate it, unquote. Now, come on, guys. We are talking about DARPA. We know that DARPA is sprinkle-funded much of the Brain Initiative across universities and hospitals for quite a while now, all in the name of curing PTSD, and then it became Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and then we wanted to know how to put in, you know, mind-controlled prosthetics and brain implants, push little chemical buttons. Well, now they're working with a marketing firm, and they want to find a way to understand human behavior, monitor that behavior, and of course, 21st Century Cures Act, surveillance for neurological monitoring, unobtrusively, of course. Sparks and Honey is also working with the Department of Defense on other efforts around, quote, how to prevent technological surprises for the U.S. government, unquote, which is one of the main goals of DARPA. Mr. Young, the CEO of Sparks and Honey, said that the work tied to the Cortex, I want to know what the Cortex is, will soon expand for a wide array of companies across Omnicom in both marketing, policy, and government issues. Last February, a group of ad and technology executives met with the U.S. Justice Department in D.C. What? Ad executives and technology executives met with the Department of Justice to come up with a plan to counter extremist propaganda from the Islamic State. The gathering was dubbed the Madison Valleywood Project. And it was attended by who? Oh, Twitter, Facebook, and several major creative agencies. So there you have it, people. DARPA is now working with a big ad firm in New York City that's brought in some other technological group, and they're going to run something called the Cortex to start understanding human behavior, monitoring it, and trying to determine why people become disenchanted and radicalized. And like I said, the 21st Century Cures Act has a whole section on neurological monitoring. Of course, it's going to be all in the name of poor old Nana, who can't seem to remember where her house is after she goes out for a walk. But don't worry about that, because I saw they have these new shoe inserts just for Nana with little GPSs in them. You can GPS Nana and track her 24/7 on your smartphone. Soon that'll be for little Johnny as well. Well, I guess we maybe can hit this last story in the last 2 minutes. And if you had to worry about them neurologically monitoring us or behaviorally monitoring us or understanding what our next step is going to be, or, hey, even if Nana gets lost or whatever, we have Smart Dust. I've talked about Smart Dust before. I've been watching it since the 90s when I was elbows deep in technology. They were already working on it at Hewlett Packard, and I've actually found some evidence. I actually found an old PDF out of one of my old tech magazines that had talked about HP, and it was back from the 90s, like maybe 95, 96. Talked about HP and their Smart Dust project, so I knew I didn't hallucinate on that one. Be hard to find any connection now. But Smart Dust, the future of involuntary treatments of the public. And this came out of Heather Callaghan's publication, The Natural Blaze. Smart Dust is a name given to extremely small computing particles or RFID chips or other very small technologies. And a popular article from Extreme Tech describes it in the headline, Smart Dust, a complete computer that is smaller than a grain of sand. An article from War is Boring is titled, Future Military Sensors Could Be Tiny Specks of Smart Dust. New technologies allow for extremely small and ubiquitous military sensors. A paper from the University of California, San Diego also describes Smart Dust as originally referring to miniature wireless semiconductor devices, but these devices are now incorporated into sensing, computing, and communications in a centimeter-sized package. It is promoted as an eventuality that Smart Dust will cover the streets and buildings to identify people, that people have Smart Dust in their bodies, and other things in the mainstream television and media, and they paint a utopian, blissful picture. Now remember, Smart Dust is all about bringing everything onto the Internet of Things, which then they decided to call the Internet of Everything. I, with a small little O and a capital E, Internet of Everything. And that's exactly what they are doing. And we will continue with Smart Dust, AI Takeover, and Rain.